I'm Hugo Desler from Farming Circuits. We have the pleasure to have online Peter Andrews. Now, Peter Andrews is a very important person, as Major General Jeffrey has had to say. There's 500,000 acres of agriculture in Australia, and his regard says that 350,000 of those acres are in a state of deterioration. And so, most farmers in that 350,000 acres, and rather, so on that proportion, I think what Peter's got to say is extremely important. Now, Peter, rather than me trying to explain to people what you're on about, could you introduce yourself as to what you do when it comes to farming?
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Peter Andrews, really. It's identifying those processes that are sustainably available, in other words, sunlight and atmosphere, and the only way we can get them into products and stop the landscape degrading is by a variety of whole biodiversity group of plants, and then managing the reaction that gravity and water has. So in other words, we've got to shift fertility from the low ground back to the high ground after we've filtered it. Fundamentally, if we could align our agricultural practices to evaluating the green area and then the way in which we keep that green area functioning at its greatest rate for the longest period of time, and then recycle the residues of that from the high ground down, that's really what I'm talking about. But the real bottom line is the Australian landscape had to come up with the very most efficient ways that those processes could be managed. And I was fortunate enough some years ago to recognise the skeleton of those processes and then be able to reintroduce them. So really what I'm talking about is a laboratory that has gone through the processes that man did. In other words, it broke away from rivers that came out of Antarctica. So we had three large floodplains that lost the service of their rivers. And it came up with this process. So it's the solution that nature's developed that man still has to grapple with, because he's done these sorts of things to nearly every river in the world. So it's very difficult to explain all the components, but in real simple terms, that's as close as I can get to identifying the major components.
Now, Peter, you've had a fair bit to do with the land right from your childhood through to what you're doing now, is spending a lot of time out on farms. So can you give a bit of a history on how your past, very briefly, on how you sort of come across this way of regenerating our landscape?
Well, I was born in the 40 back in Broken Hill when in the 1820s to the 40s, every tree within 50 miles of Broken Hill that they could get a wagon alongside was cut down and either burnt in the smelters or used for pit props in the mines. So we had a landscape dramatically altered for quite a big area. And then, of course, it turned into quite amazing grassland because it's really fertile country. But one of the things that came to me when I was very, very young, we had an extreme cycle of weather over about 6 weeks, and then it culminated in a very bad day. And every piece of vegetation that was left, because there was no coarse vegetation to protect it, was blown away. And I watched the land go from, moderate climate to extreme climate and desertification, and that lasted for 2 years. And then we were lucky enough to get 15 points of rain. Then 10 days later it rained an inch and a bit overnight, and the resilience was still in that landscape, so overnight it turned green again. And they were the sort of profound things that a landscape can do if we look after the resilience in it. And I've seen that disappearing everywhere in Australia since then, and I know now that if in fact those cycles happen, it would require a far more drought-tolerant sort of rain series to bring some of these landscapes back. So the problem is then we don't get those types of cycles very often, in which case landscapes go into a permanent desertification, which obviously happened in the Middle East and many other parts of the world, and some of our central landscape is suffering the same fate, you know. And some of the issues that I like to bring to people's attention, that man, doesn't matter whether he's been black or white or a hunter-gatherer or whatever, has had an impact on landscapes. And there's evidence, clear evidence, that 15,000 years ago, Lake Eyre was a forested wetland with fresh water. And by disrupting vegetation, by burning and so on, you release these natural balances in the landscape, and of course that causes imbalances such as the toxic lake, which the Lake Eyre is. And of course when you go through Western Australia and places like that, many of the valleys have gone the same way recently in just the last 50 years. And so I see it in Tasmania, Kangaroo Island, everywhere in the landscape, these patterns are appearing. And the single issue is we don't understand the hydrology or the relationship that plants used to have in that hydrology. And if we did, I'm sure we could reverse all those situations. I'm not sure that covers everything you want, but I mean, the big issue, I suppose, I moved into the Hunter Valley after having all that experience in Broken Hill, and then farmed for 15 years in Round Adelaide, where we had no biodiversity and the health of the animals was terrible. And then when I got to the Hunter Valley, there was the greatest biodiversity I'd ever seen, mostly from introduced plants. And yet it was resilient. It had gone into a stage of quite affected by salinity because people had changed the pattern of water that used to exist. And I was sort of fortunate that I just looked at some previous old maps and sort of said, well, this pattern is completely different to what used to be there and had functioned successfully for thousands of years. If I repeat that water pattern, I wonder what will happen. And of course, the rest is history. And so I then said to people, we have to appreciate that there is a natural and predictable pattern to fertility and salinity in a landscape. And I guess it's been a battle for 30 years getting people to really respect that landscapes are living organisms. They have processes and functions in them. And if we respect them, we can do almost anything we want more effectively than has ever been achieved previously.
Peter, when it comes to how that affects farming, well, you've sort of given a bit of an illustration how it affects farming at Broken Hill, and that's a sort of pretty, well, it's now an arid, fairly arid region. And so how does what you've had to say, natural sequence farming, how does that affect the different sort of rainfalls, the farmers in different rainfall areas? In other words, how does the rainfall affect the natural rainfall?
Well, the thing is that plants grossly influence rain cycles because, you know, there's now clear evidence that in a rain event, 70% of the water has already been through plants, so that's the land-based water cycles that have a huge impact on you know, the rain cycles. So whereas Australia had these floodplain wetland systems extending right through it, they've now been drained pretty much. So instead of the landscape remaining cool enough for the daily water, which is the evaporated, transpired water every day, being recovered when it condenses at night because it was cool enough to stay down in the biosphere and therefore be available once again for the plant use, we've now got it so hot that that evaporated moisture goes straight up into the clouds. And then because the land is that much hotter than the sea, it rains on the sea more often than on the land. So we desertify landscapes by really ignoring some of the most fundamental physics that we learn when we're in sort of, you know, very early stages of you know, water and thermal dynamics of water.
But Peter, that process affects farming right through any sort of rainfall, would that be right?
Absolutely, that's exactly the point, processing, sure. And there is a group of Russians who have put real science behind this. They've spent lots of time analysing the whole world in patterns, and they say that if there's less, if the vegetation is disrupted around the coast beyond a certain level, then that process I've just described to you stops. And then when it's back reinstated, it triggers what they call a biotic pump, which each day around the coast that vegetation fills up with that evaporated moisture, when it condenses in the evening, it draws the water vapor off the sea, which is obviously warmer than the land because the trees and plants are able to evaporate so much more water than the sea would, because the surface areas of the leaves against the surface area of the sea. And that then caused this biotic pump, which that condensing water vapor causes this inflow. And it's not a sea breeze, it's triggered by water vapor rather than heat, which a sea breeze is triggered by heat. And it's a cycle quite different to that. So that biotic pump keeps pushing that water vapor inland, and if the vegetation is managed effectively, they've shown that it can effectively go for 2,000 kilometres. In which case, when that's intact, the rain at the extremity of the inland is similar to the rain at the coast. So we've got examples, of course, the Amazon, but there are many others around the place that they've cited and examined this situation. And the islands like Madeira, which were cleared and then went desertified and then have been reinstated.
So, Peter, how does this apply to a farmer himself, given in any part of Australia, or what can a farmer do to actually start doing things to, well, in our case now, to attract more moisture or more rainfall? What are the steps a farmer can take?
Well, there's a number of levels, of course. The environment is about cycles that get bigger, and obviously the bigger the cycle, the greater the influence. But the influence can be as small as somebody's backyard that's cooler than the people either side of him. So the water that's evaporated from the backyards that are hot will end up in the backyard of the one that's cooler. It is that, you know, and I give an example quite often to people. There's a lot of people, men usually, standing in the bar talking a lot of hot air, and the cold glass on the bar is running water down on top of the bar. It's that small, or it can be as large as, you know, continents.
So an individual farmer can start doing something which could have putting his farm into a step in the right direction.
The two simplest things: it becomes a mulch farmer. That's his main aim. Second aim is then he wants to work on the contour, so he's able to predict the relationships between his biodiversity. In other words, when plants such as forests live together, they become biodiverse simply because plants can't live effectively in their own residue or competitively, they will die out. So the hydrology then gives you the ability, the movement of the water down any slope, and that's in-ground water, gives you the ability to plan your planting cycles and systems. And obviously, if you have a contour system and an alley system working simultaneously, then a farm would become it's many, many times more effective in terms of managed climate, fertility, and so on. And one of the most important aspects of that, of course, is that if the alleys are sufficiently well planned and placed, you don't create this heating system, and that's going to bring in sunlight and atmosphere. And if it's working across the contour between the alleys of coarse vegetation, you grow your crops. My recommendation to most people was to plan fertility build-ups such that they would get 5 times the productivity from those target areas than they would if they cleared the whole area. And I mean, it's not new. The Russians had to do it in the steppe country after they started to destroy it. There are farmers sort of in various parts of the world. The Dow farmers have lasted for thousands of years, talking in a kind of different language, I suppose, in terms of describing what they're doing. But in principle, if you examine it, is exactly what I've just described.